It's February 4th, 2024 of the Common Era. Time is 18:14 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you again today for our study, little children. I want to refer to the Green article about three-quarters of the way through, or two-thirds, or somewhere thereabouts. There are no paragraph numbers, so we can't use that. But a lunar year begins with the first new moon after the spring equinox, is what we assumed in the Green article. And that's not what we assume in the Crucible article, which we are studying currently, and which was written after the Green article. If the lunar year begins with the first new moon that's closest to the spring equinox, whether it's after or before, then we arrive at 719 as one of the possible years for the fall of Sumeria. But in the Green article, 719 was not one of the possible years. Just wanted to note that because of the way we did it, the way we assumed that they computed the beginning of the lunar year, which is ancient times. You know, it happened a long time ago. So it's difficult for us to know exactly how they did it, but we assumed that it was done one way, and now we're assuming something different, and we're getting a different result with 719 BCE as the fall of Sumeria. That's worth noting. In the Crucible article today, we have the Arabian tradition inset, the third paragraph of that inset. Shall we read it? It says, like the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus, who commands the severe oppression of the Israelites and who is cruel, the former chemist enacts harsh laws, such as one ordering the beheading of any landowner who left unsown an area of land large enough to allow the sowing of a bushel of seed. That one would be beheaded. That was a harsh law, was it not? He becomes Pharaoh, this man, this premier of Egypt, becomes Pharaoh, marrying a woman by the name of Asiya, or Asiya. In that he is not the son of the previous Pharaoh, this is also reminiscent of the, quote, new king who did not know Joseph, end quote. When this new Pharaoh is warned that a son is born in his own household, and yet a Hebrew slave, who would be one to overthrow him and his dominion, when this new Pharaoh is warned that a son born in his household, yet a Hebrew slave, is to overthrow him and his dominion, he takes advice from the wise men of Egypt when he decides to murder all Hebrew babies of the male gender, exactly as described in Exodus, when the Pharaoh ordered the murder of the Hebrew babies, the male babies. And that's the Arabian tradition, which sounds rather familiar to us because we read the Bible and see that these things are true. That he was cruel, we see that in the Bible, and we see that he ordered the execution of the male babies. So it's fascinating that we have a separate tradition that validates the Bible. It's the Arabian tradition. And we see that he was cruel, which is consistent also with what the Bible says about how cruel he was. We know that the Pharaoh in the time of Moses... Wait a minute now. This is interesting because this is not the same Pharaoh of prophets, is it? I mean, the Pharaoh who ordered the execution of the babies in the time of Moses, yes, it was a prophet, because that was at the beginning of, that's true, beginning of Moses' life, but the Pharaoh at the time, yeah, that's true. All of these things fit the book of Exodus, chapter 1, where the Pharaoh doesn't know Joseph. That's true, isn't it? I've already done this study, you know, and I probably did it poorly. And because I forgot to turn on the audio again, which is, it just means I'm not prepared well enough. So I needed to rehearse. But I see now why I needed to rehearse that. Yeah, these things are true. But there were many pharaohs who lived in the time of Moses, because Moses lived to be 80 years old before he led the Israelites out of Egypt. So there were many pharaohs that ruled Egypt during his time, but one of them was Apophis, apparently, who fits this apothecary described by the Arabian tradition. And so his name even fits, as we discussed yesterday, and also the fact that he was cruel, it fits, and the ordering of the murder of the babies fits. Looks like we have the Arabian tradition describing the right person in terms of it being consistent with the Bible. Anyway, that's the end of our study. But, you know, and also with the name being Apophis, but that's not in the Bible. It's just from our research we determined Apophis would be the right king at the time of the birth of Moses based on the chronology, right? That's really, really interesting, is it not? So Proverbs 16 and 8 is our proverb for today, little children. Better is a little with righteousness than an abundance of products without justice. How appropriate is that for today? Remarkable. To me, I just chose a random chapter, random verse, just without thinking. I just click on it, and that's what I got. 2 Kings 19. And it came about that as soon as King Hezekiah heard, he immediately ripped his garments apart. He heard the words of Rabshakeh, the messenger of the king of Assyria, who was Sennacherib. And Hezekiah covered himself with sackcloth and came into the house of Jehovah. Further, he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the secretary, and the older men of the priests covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amoz. And they proceeded to say to him, "This is what Hezekiah has said. This day is a day of distress and of rebuke and of scornful insolence. For the sons have come as far as the womb's mouth, and there is no power to give birth. Perhaps Jehovah your God will hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria his Lord has sent to taunt the living God, and he will actually call him to account for the words that Jehovah your God has heard. And you must lift up prayer in behalf of the remnant that are to be found." So the servants of King Hezekiah came in to Isaiah. Then Isaiah said to them, "This is what you should say to your Lord. This is what Jehovah has said. Do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard with which the attendants of the king of Assyria spoke abusively of me, meaning Jehovah. Here I am putting a spirit in him, and he must hear a report and return to his own land. And I shall certainly cause him to fall by the sword in his own land." There it is, verse 7. That's the prophecy about the death of the king of Assyria, right? Now, it turns out in the chronology that we understand, he didn't die from 711 until he died in about 681 is 30 years. It was about 30 years until he actually was murdered by his own sons. And it just says he will fall by the sword in his own land. And he did, but it was by his own sons, the hand of his own sons, as we'll see at the end of this chapter. After that, Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna. This is not after he had died. This is after Rabshakeh had come and delivered the message, and then Hezekiah's associates had sent that message to Isaiah, and Isaiah had already heard about it. Of course, he would know this from Jehovah because he was a prophet. He had his own source of information, which was Jehovah. And after that, Rabshakeh returned. That's when Rabshakeh returned, was after Isaiah. And after these people had been hearing Rabshakeh talk to the people of Jerusalem from standing, you know, outside the city. And Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, for he had heard that he had pulled away from Lachish. He heard it said respecting Terheka, the king of Ethiopia, which is the king of Assyria, hearing this, "Here he has come out to fight against you." Therefore he sent messengers again to Hezekiah, saying, "This is what you men should say to Hezekiah, the king of Judah. Do not let your God, in whom you are trusting, deceive you, saying, Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria.' Look, you yourself have heard what the kings of Assyria did to all the lands by devoting them to destruction, and will you yourself be delivered? Have the gods of the nations that my forefathers brought to ruin delivered them, even Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the sons of Eden that were in Telasar? Where is he, the king of Hamath and the king of Arpad? The king of Arpad and the king of the cities of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva. Then Hezekiah took the letters out of the hand of the messengers and read them, after which Hezekiah went up to the house of Jehovah and spread it out before Jehovah. He spread out the letters. He received letters, in this case, not just a verbal message. And Hezekiah began to pray before Jehovah and say, O Jehovah, the God of Israel, sitting upon the cherubs, you alone are the true God of all the kingdoms of the earth. You yourself have made the heavens and the earth. Incline your ear, O Jehovah, and hear. Open your eyes, O Jehovah, and see and hear the words of Sennacherib that he has sent to taunt the living God. It is a fact, O Jehovah, the kings of Assyria have devastated the nations and their land, and they have consigned their gods to the fire because they were no gods, but the workmanship of man's hands, wood and stone, so that they destroyed them. So here we read that it wasn't just Israel who destroyed the gods of other nations, it was also Assyria did that, but that's not to say every nation was like that at all. And now, O Jehovah, our God, save us, please, out of his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Jehovah, are God alone. Certainly some historians have written that, I know I read it from some scholar, that only Israel would destroy the gods of other nations, like destroy the temples and all. Only Israel would do that, according to the information I was reading when I reported that, in one of my articles. And Isaiah, the son of Amoz, proceeded to send to Hezekiah. So, I mean, but we know that, see, we don't have any evidence. We know, though, you see, that we have a reason to believe that Joshua had crossed the Jordan in 1452 BCE, and that Israel had gone and destroyed these cities, because the Bible tells us he destroyed these cities. The fact that they destroyed also the gods of these other nations who were living there in the Promised Land, it was just a confirmation that it was Israel who did that destruction, because Israel was told by God to destroy these items of false worship, these idol gods. And now, O Jehovah, our God, save us, please, out of his hand, the king of Assyria, that is, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Jehovah, are God alone. And now verse 20. And Isaiah, the son of Amoz, proceeded to send to Hezekiah, saying, this is what Jehovah, the God of Israel, has said. The prayer that you have made to me concerning Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, I have heard. So Isaiah got this information from his own source, from Jehovah, directly, apparently. It doesn't say that they sent any information to Isaiah. It was just Hezekiah prayed. The king prayed, King Hezekiah. And Isaiah sent to Hezekiah saying, this is what Jehovah, the God of Israel, said. This is the word that Jehovah has spoken against the king of Assyria. The virgin daughter of Zion has despised you. She has held you in derision. Behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem has wagged her head. Whom have you taunted and spoken of abusively? And against whom have you lifted up your voice, and do you raise your eyes on high? It is against the Holy One. It is against the Holy One of Israel. By means of your messengers you have taunted Jehovah, and you say, with the multitude of my war chariots, I myself, I shall certainly ascend the height of the mountainous regions, the remotest parts of Lebanon, and I shall cut down its lofty cedars, its choice juniper trees, and I will enter its final lodging place, the forest of its orchard. I myself shall certainly dig and drink strange waters, and I shall dry up with the soles of my feet all the Nile canals of Egypt. Have you not heard? From remote times, it is what I will do. From bygone days, I have even formed it. Now I will bring it in. and you will serve to make fortified cities desolate as piles of ruins, and their inhabitants will be feeble-handed. They will simply be terrified and will be ashamed. They must become as vegetation of the field and green tender grass, grass of the roofs, when there is a scorching before the east wind. And you're sitting quiet and you're going out and you're coming in, I well know. And you're exciting yourself against me because you're exciting yourself against me and your roaring have come up into my ears. And I shall certainly put my hook in your nose and my bridle between your lips, and I shall indeed lead you back by the way by which you have come. And this will be the sign for you. There will be an eating this year of the growth from spilled kernels, and in the second year, grain that shoots up of itself. But in the third year, sow seed, you people, and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruitage. And those who escape of the house of Judah, those who are left, will certainly take root downward and produce fruitage upward. For out of Jerusalem a remnant will go forth, and those who escape from Mount Zion. The very zeal of Jehovah of armies will do this. That is why, this is what Jehovah has said concerning the king of Assyria. He will not come into the city, nor will he shoot an arrow there, meaning Jerusalem, nor confront it with a shield, nor cast up a siege rampart against it. By the way by which he proceeded to come, he will return, and into this city he will not come, is the utterance of Jehovah. And I shall certainly defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of David my servant. That's the end of that prophecy. And it came about on that night that the angel of Jehovah proceeded to go out and strike down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When people rose up early in the morning, why, there all of them were dead carcasses. Therefore Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, pulled away and went and returned, and he took up dwelling in Nineveh. And it came about, as he was bowing down at the house of Nisroch, his god, Adrammelech and Sherezer, his sons, themselves struck him down with the sword, and they themselves escaped to the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, began to reign in place of him. The date of the beginning of Esarhaddon's reign is, according to the canon of Ptolemy, 681 BCE, so that's 30 years after this invasion in 711 BCE by Sennacherib, before he became king in 704 or 703, sometime around that time when he became king. But this is interesting. He was leading the army here. He returned because of the slaughter of all of his men by some angel of Jehovah, which other people have researched at great length to try and determine how these soldiers could have all died all of a sudden. But we're told it was by the angel of Jehovah. And that's what the Bible says. But then, 30 years later, Sennacherib is murdered by his own sons as he's living in his own land. And that we saw in verse 7 was a prophecy that he would be at least returning to his own land, right? And that he would die there. That came true, that prophecy, fascinatingly. And this prophecy about the spilling of the kernels and the growth therefrom, and that in the third year, the sowing of seed, that sounds like the Jubilee year when they had to, you know, they had a Sabbath and then the Jubilee, and they didn't sow seed until the third year. And that occurred, the Jubilee year was the time of Samaria, the siege of Samaria, 722. That would be a Jubilee year. It's a Jubilee year because that's just the way it is in our genealogy, 722, and 50 years after that would be 572, and so on. So 672, 622, 572, all of those years are Jubilee years every 50 years. But whether that's a sign for the year 711, it doesn't really seem that that's the case. So all of this prophecy and all of the scriptures here in this section of 2 Kings are worthy of research, you know, to try and determine what is going on, how does this information relate to the chronology and all of that. And we've done a lot of research already, and many other people have done research and continue to do research, and we probably should continue to do research about it. And that's it for this chapter, 2 Kings 19. Let's look at Ezekiel, chapter 43. Then, little children, he made me go to the gate, as Ezekiel writes, the gate that is facing toward the east. And look, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the direction of the east, and his voice was like the voice of vast waters, and the earth itself shone because of his glory. And it was like the appearance of the vision that I had seen, like the vision that I saw when I came to bring the city to ruin. And there were appearances, like the appearance that I saw by the river Kibar. And I went falling upon my face. And the glory of Jehovah itself came into the house by way of the gate, the front of which was toward the east. And the Spirit proceeded to raise me up and bring me into the inner courtyard. And look, the house had become full of the glory of Jehovah. And I began to hear someone speaking to me out of the house. And the man himself had come to be standing beside me. And he went on to say to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I shall reside in the midst of the sons of Israel to time indefinite. And no more will they, the house of Israel, defile my holy name, they and their kings, by their fornication and by the carcasses of their kings at their death, by their putting their threshold with my threshold. Right, the thrashing and the threshold are different, even though they're spelled the same. The word thresh is the same word, but thrashing is the case for the thrashing of the grain. Its pronunciation is different. By their putting their threshold with my threshold and their doorpost beside my doorpost with the wall between me and them, and they defiled my holy name by their detestable things that they did, so that I went exterminating them in my anger. Now let them remove their fornication and the carcasses of their kings far from me, and I shall certainly reside in the midst of them to time indefinite. As for you, O son of man, inform the house of Israel about the house, that they may feel humiliated because of their errors, and they must measure the pattern. And if they actually feel humiliated because of all that they have done, the ground plan of the house and its arrangement and its exits and its entryways and all its ground plans and all its specifications and all its ground plans and all its laws, do you make known to them and write before their eyes, in order that they may observe all its ground plan and all its specifications and may actually carry them out. So there was a ground plan. Like, it sounds like there were diagrams and plans and actual drawings, but we don't have it at this time. This is the law of the house. On the top of the mountain, its entire territory all around is something most holy. Look, this is the law of the house. Now, all these plans and all this vision that Ezekiel's seeing, of course, was something that was for the future, because the temple had been destroyed already at the time when Nebuchadnezzar captured the city. The temple was destroyed, and it wasn't brought back to life until, you know, the time of the restoration of the temple in the sixth year of Darius, when it was completed, which was, you know, 70 years after its destruction, actually. And then we have, you know, the destruction having been in BCE 587 BCE. 70 years later, 517 BCE, they restored the house in the sixth year of Darius the Great, and or Darius the First. And then Ezra restored the service of the house of Jehovah in at a later time, in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, which we can date to 458 or 457 BCE. So these are the measurements of the altar in cubits. A cubit being a cubit and a handbreadth. These are the plans for the temple, which is yet to be built. And its bottom is a cubit, and a cubit is the width, and its border, this is the altar, is upon its lip round about one span, and this is the base of the altar. And from the bottom on the floor to the lower surrounding ledge, there are 2 cubits, and the width is 1 cubit. And from the small surrounding ledge to the big surrounding ledge, there are 4 cubits, and its width is 1 cubit. And the altar hearth is 4 cubits, and out from the altar hearth and upward, there are the four horns. And the altar hearth is 12 cubits in length, with 12 cubits of width squared on its 4 sides, and the surrounding ledge is 14 cubits in length, with 14 cubits of width on its 4 sides, and the border surrounding it is 1/2 cubit, and its bottom is 1 cubit round about, and its steps are facing east. And he proceeded to say to me, Son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. These are the statutes of the altar on the day of its being made, in order to offer upon it whole burnt offerings, and to sprinkle upon it blood. And you must give to the Levitical priests who are of the offspring of Zadok, the ones approaching me, is the utterance of the sovereign Lord Jehovah, to minister to me a young bull, the son of the herd, as a sin offering. And you must take some of its blood and put it upon its 4 horns and upon the 4 corners of the surrounding ledge and upon the border round about and purify it from sin and make atonement for it. And you must take the young bull, the sin offering, and one must burn it in the appointed place of the house outside the sanctuary. And on the second day you will bring near a buck of the goats, a sound one, as a sin offering, and they must purify the altar from sin the same as they purified it from sin with the young bull. On your making an end of the purifying from sin, you will bring near a young bull, the son of the herd, a sound one, and a ram from the flock, a sound one, and you must bring them near before Jehovah, and the priests must throw salt upon them and offer them as a whole burnt offering to Jehovah. For 7 days you will render up a he-goat as a sin offering for the day, and a young bull, the son of the herd, and a ram out of the flock, perfect ones, they will render up. For 7 days they will make atonement for the altar, and they must cleanse it and install it, and they will complete the days, and it must occur on the 8th day. And from then on, that the priests will render upon the altar the whole burnt offering of burnt offerings of you people, and your communion sacrifices, and I shall certainly find pleasure in you, is the utterance of the sovereign Lord Jehovah. At the end of Ezekiel 43, none of this applies to Christians directly, because these are procedures that were carried out according to the way that Jehovah used to do things back when the Mosaic Law was still in effect, and they used animal sacrifices, which we don't use nowadays. In fact, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the ransom that he gave, replaces all of those, and that was one sacrifice made for all time. There are no other sacrifices other than spiritual sacrifices that are rendered nowadays. So that's the end of our reading for today. I really do hope you enjoyed it. It's very difficult in some of these books, particularly Ezekiel. It's difficult for me. It has been difficult for me when I've been in the past reading Ezekiel, particularly this book, more so than some of the other books. Isaiah is much easier to read. Jeremiah is not as easy, I think, and Ezekiel is more difficult because of all the technical things that are talked about, especially from this section that we've been... Where did it start? Ezekiel 39, was it, or 41? No, 40. Right, it was Ezekiel 40 where this vision began. And we're in 43 now, but it's going to continue right to the end of the book. It says we've got up to 66 chapters of this stuff. It's not easy to read. So, you know, I really pray that we're going to find some meaning in it. You know, that's what we have to do day to day. We have to live with prayers day to day that we're going to find meaning every single day. Something that's going to give us more meaning in our lives. So that we, in feeling more meaning in our lives, can enjoy our lives more. That's what we really are. That's what I'm really interested in, of course, for everyone. But That's what I think everyone, many of us anyway, want to enjoy our lives. We can't force it on people. We can't say everyone does, but certainly many people want to enjoy their lives. I think that's a true statement. And, you know, in the ideal world, everyone would want to enjoy their lives, of course. But knowing how to do it is a different question. Wanting to enjoy your life is one thing. Knowing how to enjoy your life is another thing. It doesn't always mean doing only the things that you find enjoyable. Enjoyment sometimes results from doing things that for the moment are not enjoyable, but afterwards they give you a lot of understanding or peace, or they give you something that you find to be of that type of thing that does make your life enjoyable. So being able to enjoy your life, discipline, is one of the things that is helpful in allowing us to enjoy our own lives. We've been talking about health, you know, for off and on. We continue to talk about health all the time. How do we get health? And, you know, overeating is one of the big causes of disease. Maybe it causes all of the diseases that we see. Eating too much of the wrong thing, in other words, just overeating, doesn't mean large amounts of anything, but eating enough of the wrong thing so that there's no room in the body for the right thing. And sometimes fasting is beneficial, to eat nothing, so that the body can cleanse itself and rebuild after having cleansed itself of many of the things that are not useful to the body, that need to be, you know, purged from the body. So, yeah, so many things that I've written in my articles also about the history. I hope that if you have questions, you'll read the articles, because I can't remember everything, that's for sure, that I've written. I've written things, and then I've said things, and I've done, and then we read the Bible and we see that some of the things I wrote about may not be entirely according to the Bible. So we read that today in the book of 2 Kings, that the Assyrians destroyed the gods of other nations, just like Israel also did. Something that I have to stand corrected on, because I said that this was evidence that Israel was the one who conquered a particular city, because they destroyed the gods of that city. But of course, in the time when Israel conquered the Promised Land, the nation of Assyria didn't exist in the way that it did in those later times, which were, let's see, 700 compared to 14, it's 700 years later. More than 700 years later, when Assyria became a world power like that. So, yeah, there was no real concern that Assyria had destroyed those cities in the Promised Land. That wasn't even a possibility at that time, it appears, anyway. But I can say that, and then, you know, then I could be wrong again. Be careful. I should be careful. That's it for today's video. It's February 4th, 2024, of the Common Era. The time is 18:47 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much, and on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.